Hi.
Hi.
Hi, honey. So I'm Laura O'Dell, and I'm the host of this series, and this is my wonderful friend, who I haven't seen for so long.
I'm so happy to be here with you. It's like a reuniting.
It does feel like
that. And then sharing with you on the same day that we reunited.
I know. It's perfect. So it Shiloh. Is. Can you say your full name?
Yes, I'm Shiloh Sophia.
And we met about 20 years ago, I think.
I think so.
It's close to 20 years.
It's been a long journey.
It's been a long journey. And I met you, and I saw your beautiful art behind you, and I was like, I have to.
There's some paintings back there.
Paintings. Yes. And I knew that I had to have some of your art in my home. So, and you were really gracious, and we set up payment plans.
I remember delivering some of the paintings to you.
Yeah. So I have three of Shiloh's, three of your paintings. Mm. And so you're with me every day. Mm. Every single day you're with me because your art's in my home. And it's so even though we haven't seen each other in person for a long time.
Maybe 9 years?
Oh gosh, no, it can't. I don't know. No, I don't think it's been that long.
Okay.
But it's been
forever.
It's been long. So I wanted to interview you because you have been an inspiration for me of how creative you are. So I always think of you as a painter. But as you pointed out, you're a writer, and you've written this book, and you do a lot of other writing. But I'm a visual person, even though I'm a writer, and I've done visual art. But yeah, I think of you as a painter. So I want to talk to you about the general process of your creativity.
Okay.
Because one thing also, you're creative. I see you're creative, but also extremely prolific. And our audience is mainly going to be artists and authors, and I feel as a writer, I definitely have writer's block. So what I do for my writer's group is I have pens and paper and coloring books out, so that's an option if people get stuck with their writing. And I've seen people pick up the pens and they start doodling. So it's that left brain, right brain. So maybe you can talk more about that as this all-round artist that you are.
The left brain, right brain connection.
Yeah.
What I feel like dropping into has to do with flow, or being in the zone, as they say.
Right.
That when we are working with image and language, there's an opportunity to drop into a space of flow, which sort of bypasses the usual structures of the prefrontal cortex and takes us into a flight space, a possible space. And when people are really, like, really writing or really painting, they're usually there. Even if they don't totally acknowledge or know that they are there, they've had an experience of being sort of on a journey or receiving messages from the divine or having downloads. And it's because we're in this state that we've brought ourselves into through the creative process. And so for me, it's that combination of image, language, and inquiry, which we call intentional creativity. It's all of them together that really makes up the magical concoction in our Muses lab over here.
I love that, the Muses lab. And we were talking just before we switched on the camera. We did switch off the camera. about the Muse. And we talked about offering a goodie, a free gift to the to the audience. And you were sharing a couple of things that you could share, and they all sounded wonderful. And definitely you could talk about all of them because people would be interested. But I said, let's do the Muse. So this might be a good time to talk about that.
And
then we can come back to that at the end.
Well, the book I've just recently published is sort of a 20 years in the making called Tea with the Midnight Muse. And it's 20 years of poems that are invocation-like, that are great for the opening of circles and ceremonies and to uplift and to beginning of workshops. And then each one is followed by an inquiry process for the individual to digest the material. And the Muse in our community, I mean, different cultures say different things about the Muse. And so right. I would say that we have come to work with the muse inside of a language structure that we've created, which is access to your own voice.
Right.
And that when we don't have access to our own voice, we're often dealing with what people would call the critic or the internal predator or, you know, any number of stories that we've made up about the voice when it's being cruel. And what we feel in our community is that that voice is the same voice as the muse. It's just an atrophied expression.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so when we're talking about the muse, we're not talking about something external, although there's many legends of external muses
right.
and many
right.
writers and painters who talk about
yeah.
their muse. And then there's also external beings who people call their muse. So it really is whatever it means to you. In our case, we're looking at it as access to one's own creative voice and that you could access that as needed.
Right.
And so the gift that we decided to offer you is called Tea with the Muse. It's an older work of mine, and it's basically a 5-step painting process to listen to and receive a message from your muse for people that are not painters necessarily, but who just want to get with the mojo of that creative life force and work with an image. Again, no experience needed.
It's wonderful. And
it's a fun, yeah.
But there is one coming up, and for years I've wanted to take one of your workshops, and I've always sort of gone off, you know, it's prioritizing, I think, so much of the time, but going off in different directions. My direction was, you know, starting school from scratch and then graduating with my MFA last year. But I love it that you do offer these workshops, and it was my therapist who reminded me, because she said, I signed up for one of Shiloh's workshops. Do you know Shiloh? And of her work. I said, oh, I do.
Yes.
I do.
Well, it's this thought of, you know, we've equated painting in particular and writing with talent, with education, with skill, with know-how, with experience. But the negative part of what that's done is that it has separated our pure, raw, creative drive from our capacity to do it. So when it is determined, when you're younger, that you're either not a good painter, not a good drawer, not a good singer, or not a good writer, then you should basically just not do that, as if
right.
it has something to do with skill.
Right.
But actually, everyone's creative.
Yeah.
Every single bone in our body is creative. We are creations living inside of a creation who must create.
Right.
And when we don't do that, we get sick one way or
right.
another.
Right.
Create sick relationships, get sick in our body, sick in our mind. We have to create to get the flow flowing. And when we don't, we make choices that are not in alignment for us, not alignment for the earth, basically not connected to consciousness. Creativity is access to consciousness. Can be.
I think that's really important. But I think you just touched on this point of, if you're not creative, what can happen? And so much... I went to an art show in London. It was about 10 years ago, and it was at a major gallery. I think it was the South Bank Gallery. And the exhibition was The Art of the Insane. And it just really caught my eye. You know, it was like, okay, I've been to, you know, 100 Monet, you know, shows. And I love, you know, all the beauty, and I love Monet, and I, you know, love all these, the artists that we know, like Picasso. But there's so many other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went, and it was incredible, incredible art. From, you know, 50 to 100 years ago, people who were, you know, locked up in these places that are called, you know, insane asylums.
Mm-hmm.
But the art was mind-blowing. I mean, each person, each artist could have had their own show.
Yes.
But I think that's really important of the, you know, depression. And I think, you know, how many, they say millions of people are on antidepressants in the United States alone.
Yes.
And I don't want to say that medication, you know, I think medication could be a lifesaver for some people. But, you know, what would happen if, and I think there's more of this, you know, and there's, as we know, there's art therapy. And we can title it art therapy. But people, I would imagine, doing even your workshops, that you're not necessarily saying, this is art therapy.
No, we're definitely not calling it that, although it can be therapeutic.
Yeah.
But we're not saying that, mostly so we don't get in trouble.
Yeah.
And to respect the field of art therapy, which is quite distinct from what we actually do. And the work that happens here in our work, which is a global movement of intentional creativity, we have 150 women who teach this around the world. And the hope is that we create an environment that has a sense of ritual, whether we say that outwardly or not. You walk into a space, either online or in person, and you're invited into an experiential environment with an inquiry. Mm-hmm. And you go on your own deep dive. And the teacher is simply holding space and is trained to hold space for the happening. And then the individual, given some instruction and tools, can discover their own medicine. Yeah. And I have seen so many somewhat miraculous style healings when people, like, think of the title of your series.
Right.
Right, which is
Write Your Story, Heal Your Life. Yeah.
So when we paint and write, which we paint and write in this methodology, the story can shift. Mm-hmm. So when story can atrophy, not unlike a critic gone wrong, a lot of times it's stuck energy. It's stuck in your field, stuck like a record playing over and over, or like an image you just can't get out of your head, and you can't think yourself out of it because we would have already done that by now.
Right.
So how then do you move a really stuck thing that is causing breakdown and ultimately depression and isolation and disidentification with your own alignment and sovereignty? How do you get back to that?
Right.
I know that the medications and the therapies provide, you know, hopefully temporary relief and bridges, but if the individual is going to take on the work of their own mental health, even if there's no issues, apparently, which I don't know anybody who doesn't have some.
I'm not going to get into my issues.
Then what are the ways that we would self-medicate with creating? And so when people paint or write, I feel like they start freeing up, like giving oxygen to the suffocated self who is silenced inside their story.
And, you know, when you said that, I noticed I have my breath. I held my breath. And I'm working primarily with writers in memoir. And it started because I was working on a novel as my thesis. And my professors loved it, but I was also doing this memoir writing. And the chair of my program said, "Oh, Laura, write your memoir as your thesis. It's the story that you know." So I've ended up doing that in my classes, and that's where I made the leap of write your story, know your life. Because I work with women, and especially working with women, the stories that people share are profound. Profound, you know, the so many things that have happened in people's lives. But I think writing and going into the creativity, that you start to unpack and unlayer.
Absolutely. And get clarity.
And get clarity.
The written piece and the painting provides a witness.
Yes.
And I think the memoir writing is so healing, because we don't know what we know about ourselves. We also don't know what we've been through. And when you start to articulate it, that's when the muse can come in and tell you something you didn't even know. You sit down, you think you're going to tell a story.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, wow, I didn't know I thought that about that. And there it is.
And with that, I was just thinking about your book. And you were telling me before we switched on the camera about some of the things that are in the book, including prayers. And I think this is a great moment just to, if you would read
something for us. Oh, no problem.
Yeah.
Love to. Let me see what wants to emerge. What wants to come forward.
I was thinking as we were speaking earlier that I was given a book by a friend by Tosha Silva. The Change Me Prayers. And in there, she talks about, you know how when you were talking about the inner critic, and these things that we say to ourselves, and I think men, women, you know, the trans community, everybody, of, you know, we really can beat ourselves up, and, you know, especially around body image and you know, when we age. And she mentioned in her book, you know, you wouldn't talk to a friend like that. You wouldn't be mean to a friend. And yet it's acceptable. It's become acceptable to be mean to ourselves.
And it's quite global. I mean, they've done studies, and it's really all cultures have this. And the stories aren't that different from each other. And there's actually not that many. They're stemming around worth, love, you know, being a mistake, being betrayed. Like, they all equal that we're ashamed, we're not good enough to be loved. Like, it all is, the stories are widely varied, but the meanings that we make about them are pretty global. And so we see a pattern across the world then that we can, as a global community, start to work with.
And as you mentioned, I didn't realize that you are working in this global community. You said you had 150 people.
150 teachers.
Yes.
Where we teach thousands of women a month.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing.
And it's incredible. You're such an inspiration, because I know you were painting long before and writing before I met you.
Yeah.
But I feel that I sort of met you when you were sort of just...
At the beginning. Yeah. It's been 25 years that I feel so awesome saying that now. Like, for 25 years, I haven't gone off my path. And I haven't. It's been pretty obsessive. I kind of just said, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it no matter what. Only I didn't dominate the process in that I didn't know what was going to happen. I just knew it was about creativity, healing our story, being with women, making images that are alternative images of the feminine. But I started with coloring books in the beginning of my career. I didn't know what it was going to become.
Right.
I did follow the voice of the muse, and let, I would say, the cries of the world show me where to go. So I listen to those, and when something gets loud enough, like a collective cry, like a lot of the writings in here aren't even personal experience. It's really like, for months or years, I'll hear a particular story rolling in the collective unconsciousness and then start to surface above ground. And then one person will tell me, and then suddenly it's like, and then usually it's, I write it, then I paint it, and then I invite other people to the conversation. So it's, and I'm like, yeah, but it didn't happen to me, but it's sort of, I guess I'm open to hearing it.
Right.
So it's been interesting. So in that way, I've been called forward by the voices of women, as opposed to like making a goal and setting out to create this amazing business and community, which I do have, but it's, didn't come from a business plan.
For me, and it's a projection, it's, to me it sounds almost like a channeling, you know, it's sort of, sometimes we just sort of, we're this vessel.
Yeah, it's coming through.
It reminds me, I really would love you to read, and I just popped into my head, I was reading Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic, and in there she shares this story that she came up with an idea for a story, and it was really vivid to her, and she's like, this is the story I'm going to write. But then she got distracted, and you know, Eat, Pray, Love came, and another story, and then she met with, for the first time, Anne Pratchett. I think, I'm very sure it's Anne Pratchett, and then she said, was talking to her, and she said to Anne, so what's your latest project, what novel are you, you know, what book are you reading and writing? And She said, well, I'm writing this story, and she described it's pretty much the exact same story, and Elizabeth Gilbert hadn't told anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so Elizabeth Gilbert has all these theories about that, but one being, you know, like we chat, like she didn't write this story,
mm-hmm.
but it was coming to her.
Mm-hmm.
So did that story just go, okay, you know,
Liz
isn't ready, let's take it to Anne. So on that note,
yeah.
I loved it.
Thank you. So this is called Bone Gathering. Returning to oneself after a long voyage into the desert is the work of all beings that we all must do one day. The day will come when the absence of the missing bones and the pieces of your heart you left to die after too many mornings waking up alone in body or spirit or both will require you to return. For this sacred work, a map for returning will be provided so you can find the missing persons reports. This map is not in language that you will understand. Are you surprised? With each stop on the quest, there may be a sitting down hard head and hands wondering why, and even despair you thought you had gone far beyond. Grief and wonder are the companions you will find, because they are also the way through the hard to see places. Give in to them. You will be okay. I wish I could say it could be easier than this. Hiding, cutting, dismembering ourselves wasn't so easy, was it? We did it to survive, we thought, and we wrapped up the bloody limbs and continued on. Almost soldier-like in our sacrifice of ourselves. Never mind the blood loss of not being ourselves. Never mind not even knowing what song belongs to our mouth and what movement belongs to our body. And what movement our body loves the most. How did we go on this way? Well, that's done now. No more, we say. That is how we found ourselves here. This excavation requires specialized tools. If it didn't, bone gathering would have started long before now. Yes, I know you have already started. I have seen this in your tender eyes. Don't worry. It's scary at first. The tools are intact for user-friendly excavation, and you will find they fit in the palm of your hand just so. The stranger within you knows how to use each one. She was the one yelling at you before. Listen, listen, listen inside the soul cave. But now that you have listened to her, she will be the one to help you see in the dark. And the horns are going off. This is the one we call the muse. Visionary bones are made of stardust, and their sparks glow in the darkness. Come, you will find them. You have to. I need you to. I have gone a bone gathering, and I found this poem here in the earth and brought it to you for lighting. Brush the dust from your feet, and you will find words dry enough to ignite your embers.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Really beautiful.
Yeah. So it's that sense of going back to the places that we have left behind.
Right.
And just saying, you know what? I'm calling that back now.
Calling it back. One thing that, because I'm a visual person,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think I mentioned that even though I'm a writer, which is visual, you know,
yeah.
you're seeing the words, but... You know, I learn visually, and I'm not good on audiobooks. You know, I'll start, when people listen to audiobooks as they're driving, I just go off somewhere else, you know. But it made me think, what the visual that I got when you read that piece was the cave art.
Mm.
You know, Lascaux,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, some of the oldest art that we know of in the world.
Mm-hmm. I was just looking at some of that this morning, and I found this amazing image of a Mesopotamian woman, I can't remember from what year, gathering honey.
Oh, beautiful.
I'd never seen it before.
Beautiful.
I was just like, there's the bees, there's the honey. She's up on a ladder.
Oh.
That's cave art, yeah.
Oh, I'll
show it to you.
Yes, I'd love to see that. Yes, because, you know, I think, we have this idea, many people, that, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, you know, with Neanderthals, you know, it sort of can go to, you know, the specific, you know, human beings types, but that people are in survival mode, that, you know, they're sort of hunters and gatherers, etc. But then finding this beautiful art mm-hmm. in the caves, that no, art was important then. People have yes. been creating always. Yes.
And in the Lascaux Cave, the star maps on the cave walls are the stars from that night or during that time zone. So there's a lot more going on there than we give credit for, and then you think of, I mean, we give credit to it, but you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more available, and then you think of all the images of the mothers and of the feminine, that without that art,
right.
we wouldn't actually have any really awareness that this hasn't always been, that deity hasn't been primarily thought of as masculine by the masses.
Exactly. Well, there's so much of the art from matriarchal cultures. You yeah. know, if you go back to Chateau Hayek and yeah. Anatolia,
yeah.
the oldest civilization that's known, that their images were female. You know, there's that beautiful image of the woman, the goddess, and she's sitting and she has her two lions
yes.
with her. And you can see those, the actual figures in the museum in Ankara, in mm-hmm. Turkey. And it's so important, I believe, for men and women to see these images.
I agree. I mean, you know, thinking about, if you read Chalice and the Blade by Rayanne Eisler now, you're kind of like, wow, if somebody, once somebody reads this, they're going to understand we're picking the chalice or the blade, but we don't. We didn't get it. We're
right.
still not really getting it.
Right.
You know, and I think the reference to the ancient images of the feminine is important. Not that we're trying to return to that.
Right, right.
I think that's a key piece for me anyway. It's not like a return to a matriarchy or an exit of a patriarchy. It's like a whole new thing
right.
needs to get created
right.
that we need to enter now. And there's this thought of like we keep waiting for everyone to enter it. On one hand, like when are we going to create the future that we want, the world we want to see, and I want to work towards that all the time. But it's lately it's just been coming clearer and clearer, like each of us inside of our own souls has to reconcile this irreconcilable paradox
right.
of where we are as a culture, as a people, whether that's, you know, gender or climate change or, you know, endangered species or right. like we were talking about earlier, sex
right.
trafficking.
Yeah.
Like each of us has to first to show up as awake, do our own work of discovery, of history, of
right.
looking at where are we on the timeline. And how do we get ourselves current to this moment?
Right.
And for me, creativity is one of the ways to create identity currency.
Identity currency. I would like to explore that more
yeah.
with you, because when I've seen your art, you know, being, you know, just looking around and just seeing more of it, It's so much of the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I was so drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier of Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know more about your mm-hmm. your connection to Mary Magdalene. Yes, because I have some thoughts. I have some other thoughts, because I was in the south of France a few
mm-hmm,
years ago
mm-hmm.
in Carcassonne.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cathars
mm-hmm.
who were there, they believed that they were the their ancestors, their ancestry was Jesus and
mm-hmm.
Mary Magdalene. That
mm-hmm.
Jesus and Mary Magdalene actually... Jesus lived, and they went to the south of France, and they had children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. But how we demonize, well, not getting too much off the subject of creativity, but, you know, some people will be thinking of Mary Magdalene as their muse. You know, we pick
mm-hmm.
different muses if
mm-hmm.
if there's one outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, you know, she's been very demonized. And so I'm interested for your connection with her, because mm-hmm. I think that you're not demonizing her mm-hmm. at all.
No. And the whole thing about her being a prostitute was something that's, you know, fairly recent.
Yes.
Almost a strange mistake. It was barely even systematic, but once it got out there, it just got propagated.
Right.
And there are certain traditions, like before the Orthodox and the Catholic split apart. So for the first 1,000 years, there's no images of her as the harlot. It's only post the separation. So I think that's important to know. Like, it's really pretty recent, and now they've rectified that because it's not even in scripture. So it's just right. something that they did to continue to do that to her. Now, why do you think they'd want to do that? That's where the question really is. And regardless of what the story is, because I don't think anybody knows. I don't think it's knowable. I think we're in a great mystery school right now. Yeah. I think anytime we think we're close, it's exciting and we feel closer to the divine, and then it disappears in a poof of smoke in a conversation with someone else because we're like, wait, what was that genius thought I had that I was getting closer to the truth? The more I study, the less I have any understanding of anything that's true, to be honest. Right. So all I have to do is look at story, at the mythos that has remained. Mm-hmm. Not what truth is, but the mythos that has remained. And not even why that one did, but just, okay, here's the story. That's generally happening in the collective. And I would say with her, if I was going to pick on one point of why I feel like that she, one, why is she rising up within the feminine and for men right now? One of the most popular female images in the world right now.
Right.
There's that. And then there's why was she demonized before that or made into a woman who, you know, was thought to be unacceptable as a harlot. So right. just to be clear, it doesn't say that anywhere.
Yeah.
It does say that, that demons were cast out.
Ah.
But it does not say that she was a harlot. There's no evidence of that, actually. But why? Of all the reasons, and now my theory, is that when, if you look at the mythos of the Christ story, when he gets up from the grave, overcoming matter to take on his next form, mm-hmm. he folds his clothes and goes out into the garden, rolls the stone away, maybe with some help of some angels.
Right.
And goes out into the garden. Now, I always imagine him on that morning being like, it worked. You know, I am myself.
Right.
Amazing. What this means is that others can do this. We have victory over matter.
Right.
Okay, so that's right. big story.
Right.
And then him going, wow, you know, it's early in the morning. It's super early on Sunday morning because we know it's the Sabbath because the women didn't come with the herbs
right.
on the Sabbath day. So it's early, early in the morning. And he's out there in the garden and he's like, I get to choose my appearance and think how excited all my friends are going to be that it actually worked.
Wow.
And he's sitting there thinking, ooh, how am I going to do this? Because also now he can astral travel and
right,
whatever he
right.
wants,
right? Right.
And he chooses to appear to Mary Magdalene. Mm. That is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So in that mythos, the resurrected being who is embodiment of light and matter, who now has mastery over form, makes a decision who to speak to and who to give the message to. And so he gives it to her. She's the apostle to the apostles, the one speaking to them. Immediately, they don't believe her.
Right.
Okay. The story goes on from there.
Right.
We'll just say that that sovereign Lord, even to all the patriarchal traditions of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, that male being, in their view, chose the feminine to reveal himself to. And he did it over and over and over and over. The woman at the well, the woman with the issue of blood, the woman who anointed him. He did this. This was his pattern.
Right.
And what are we doing? Did we believe her?
Right.
Instead, what happens?
Right.
Right? And regardless of, you know, all the stories of, like, the kids and what they ended up doing or whatever, like, those always happen around these great beings. I have no idea what happened, but the relevancy for me is that he picked her. They didn't acknowledge that. Then they find out for themselves, but they still never really acknowledge her as the one who brought forth the story. And then she does end up going off, according to the legends, to France in a rudderless boat, and that's where the cookies come from. The Madeleine cookies, you know the Madeleine cookies?
Oh, yes, yes.
Those are named after her.
Okay.
And they're either in the shape of a boat or the shape of a seashell from the ocean. Those are about her journey there. So I think this is still happening, this maligning of the feminine. And when we reclaim our voice and our own sovereignty, which is very palpable in dance, creativity, all acts, pottery, painting, writing, as women, because I think that's most of our viewers, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think so.
We reclaim ourselves through creativity, and we become central to our own story. And we do the honor of bringing other women as central to their own story again. Because we're like, oh, but her story. Oh, all the women that were silenced from history. They've always been there. Think of art in the museums. Less than 5% of museums worldwide feature women.
Yes.
Meanwhile,
We
know. We know better.
We know better.
And so creativity is one of the ways I work with women to bring self-empowerment, that they could have authorship of their own story, and no one else is going to tell it for us. In fact, they're going to change it.
Right.
So how can we take responsibility for our own story?
Yes, and that's such another important piece that you mentioned, because I love art. You know, growing up in London, I had access to art. Even growing up in, you know, with a... I grew up in a slum. You know, I lived in a slum. So there was no luxury money to pay for art galleries or museums. But they're free. They're still free, most of them, in England. So I'd go off and see this art. And so I'm almost like an addict when it comes to art. And I was, you know, at MoMA... No, I was at the De Young, and it was a year or two ago, and I was looking at this exhibition. I think it was the Dutch Masters or something. And beautiful art, you know, and you've got Rembrandt, etc. But then I just got it. I'm looking around the room, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just all white men. It's all white men. And it doesn't mean that their art wasn't amazing.
Or that they weren't amazing.
Exactly.
It's just what story is being chosen to be told from his perspective.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I do want to know about, you know, some great male. You know, I have nothing against men, you know, love them. The good ones, I love them. Just like, the, you know what I mean? But, yes, I want to know more about the work. So that's another reason why I'm so intrigued about your work. And feel that it's so important because you work, it seems primarily women are drawn to you. And I think it's something intuitively is telling me it's because women are going, where is my voice? Where has my voice been for the last 2,000 years? Especially in this, you know, Judaic Christian last 2,000 years that we've had.
Well, I mean, before that, the Judaic, you know, before the Christ.
So, yes.
You know, it's been going on for a while, and I actually want to go back and really do my research at advent of that transition, which is a really interesting space, because in theory, if, you know, since we did talk about Christ and Magdalene, like, in theory, after him, this should have been abolished.
Right.
So any... buddy who's a Christian who's operating inconsistent with what he made available, which was the liberation of the feminine, is inconsistent with what he did and said. And, you know, there's this part where he's anointed by a woman, and the guys are like, do you know who this is? And blah, blah, blah. This is one of the scenes they say is Mary Magdalene. We don't actually know if it was her, but she's often cast in this role. And he says, this thing that she has done will be spoken of as a memorial to her wherever the gospel is preached. Well, have you ever heard a preacher talk about it?
Right.
They don't. It's the only thing he said to say every time.
Right.
Why? Why was that important to him? And how did that even get maintained in the scripture with all those guys editing it? So, you know, so we're not even doing what it said. He changed so many things. And so I think, and one of the reasons for that as part of the conversation is just that, you know, as people, we've had deities, male and female deities, all of our life, like from the beginning of the beginning.
Right.
And right now we're sort of in this one, and we are in a death throes with
right.
the functionality of how these world, you know, this is active in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, of course, from that particular story, but it's in Buddhism, it's in Hinduism, it's in every major spiritual tradition. Even in a lot of the Wiccan traditions, a lot of the women are in sexualized relations, are subjugated or rescuing some, you know.
Right.
It's like, wow, what is going on here?
And, it, you know, we were talking earlier off camera about what is going on here.
What is going on?
And we were having a conversation about, you know, it could be seen as off topic, but I think as if we're talking about the divine feminine, and I see the divine feminine in your personal work, mm-hmm. in your art, that why, we were talking about why,
yeah.
why is there such a strong sense, and not just a sense, a reality of misogyny,
yeah.
and how do we shift that? How do we shift mm-hmm. the paradigm? And I believe that one of the ways is that we are empowered as human beings. We're individually empowered. And one of the ways is, is art accessible? Can we, mm-hmm. can this creativity and empowerment, mm-hmm. and which you spoke about earlier, can we access that individually?
And I think that we can, which is why in our work we focus a lot with painting the image of the feminine for ourselves, because we re-image her for ourselves. And a lot of women still, and men, have no idea about the matriarchal images. And so, and I don't focus on those except from a historical perspective, although I do paint the Blessed Mother. But it's like when women create their own self-image made in her image, is what we made her in is our image. And so when we paint ourselves for ourselves or her as us or any combination of things, something changes for us. We end up with a relationship of beauty and sovereignty and power that's feminine that we made ourselves. And it changes women's lives. And they hang it in their home and they hang it in their practice. And I remember coming to your house and hanging the painting over the fireplace.
Right.
Or, you know, it's like
right.
We are changing the visual culture and rejecting pornography,
right.
Starvation images, all of that stuff. That's women's image never stopped being promoted. They just shifted it from the mother of corn and water
right.
to the women of sell you the fast car and the insurance.
Right.
She's never actually disappeared.
Right.
She's just been demoted into a sales position
right.
to sell to men and women.
Right.
She never actually went away.
That what you had just addressed reminds me there was a film made, Killing Her Softly. I think it's Killing Her Softly, not Killing Me, Killing Her Softly. And it was made by, I can't remember her name, but it was, I think she's a professor and a researcher, and it showed exactly that, but women being used to sell, but the images that she shows in her presentation is, you don't even see the women's faces. So it's the bodies, you know,
yeah.
like breasts and, you know, like
yeah.
butts and all of that. And it's such a profound film
mm-hmm.
because it's all these images that we see. And I think until I saw that documentary.
Right. We weren't even going to notice, hardly.
It didn't really sort of compute. Like, oh, that's what's happened.
Yes. And so our community has put the heads back on everybody, you know, because we have these giant heads taking over the world of images of the feminine. Like, and but it's and each woman is in a different spiritual place, a
right.
different spiritual tradition.
Right.
And But something changes about even what's acceptable to us or even what we consider classically beautiful. We kind of get off of the, this is the idealized beauty, and we move into like, what's really hot is me as me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, but that's, it's hard to even teach that.
Yeah.
It's something about this creativity is needing to be experienced.
Right.
Because you can tell people about it, you can talk to people about it, but the seeing it is key. And then in our case, the actual articulation of it in image and in language. Because after we finish the paintings, we say, what is the message of the painting?
Right.
What does the painting have to communicate to you? And then you get these trippy messages from the hidden psyche of the feminine that help you recover. I just want to say, like, in this conversation, I am married to a man. I love men. Like,
yes.
this isn't actually about gender in
yes,
the weirdest possible
gender.
Way.
Yeah.
It's not about feminism. It's not about gender. It's not about goddess worship. This is actually addressing a topic that's impacting the safety of our entire planet and the future of our world and the subjugation of water and women. It's just what's happening. And we are working each in our own way to shift it. And I feel like part of my assignment is to not even one woman at a time, because sometimes we have thousands of people come to one class.
Right.
To recalibrate first to consciousness, to understand for ourselves, form our own views about what's happening, orient ourselves in identity currency, like here I am as me, and then now what is it that I'm here to speak about or say? And it takes some practice, and it sometimes takes years for women to find their voice, even after they've identified it, all the violations.
Yes.
And so that's my, what I call the piece of the red thread. Unique piece of the red thread is to guide women to create images that are recovery and empowerment, so that they can create environments and relationships and businesses and projects that are consistent with an image of themselves as empowerment and an experience of themselves as healed, whole, and holy. And each of us has to do that in our own way. And this is just one of the ways that I've been working on.
Actually, it's interesting that you brought up a thread because thank you for sharing that. And I just want to take a moment to digest what you said. And I hope that viewers, because I know that it will be my intention to watch this video. Because I think, again, you know, like we're doing it now, but just to watch it and listen and then watch it and listen again. Because it's like a good movie, you know, like a good interview, and you're so articulate and you know so much, you know, with your research that you've done. You know,
just a little bit, but I'm hot about the things I did.
Yes. But, you know, each time it's like you hear something new, or it's like, oh, did I hear that before? But it sort of goes in.
Right.
Really
right.
goes in. But it's interesting with the yarn, but today I went to the mall, which is not my favorite place, but I pretty much only go there if I'm going to the Apple store, if I need something. And as I was coming out to the car park, I saw a woman get out of a car, a young woman. And for a moment, I thought she had knitting needles. And I thought, is she knitting? Amazing. And then I realized she wasn't. You know, she had a smartphone in her hand. But it, you know, I'm a knitter. You know, and I learned to knit many years ago. Actually, I learned to knit when I was pregnant with my first child. So that was, she's going to be 35. So that was like 36 years ago. And my grandmother was a knitter. They didn't learn from her. I learned from a friend. And then I would ask my grandmother, how do I do this? But in that moment, when I saw the young woman today, I just thought, wow, what about if people, not just women, because there's some great knitters who are men, that my reverend at the Center for Spiritual Living, Edward, Reverend Edward, he's a knitter. And but, you know, it's like, I feel that we're losing these arts, you know, and knitting, I think, is such an ancient art.
And think of all the pussy hats at the marches that were knit by women and men all over the world.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. And it was so amazing to see them, you know. And
yes. It caused a knitting revolution, I think.
And that's what we need.
Yes.
More than a knitting revolution. I just feel like we need a revolution in general. But, you know, just, you know, knitting is, to me, a sacred art.
Yes, they all can be, especially when you're creating something for another being, like the women making the hats. And and our the red thread is a tradition across many, many different cultures, and it's actually gender neutral,
right?
Which I love, and yet there's an umbilical cord,
right?
Which is for the same for men and women, and this is wool from Italy, and the teaching about the red thread, there are so many. Of course, one of the primary ones is that if we're supposed to be connected, we'll connect, and that we've been following the thread to each other. And the other one that we teach is that each of us has our own piece of the thread, and that you need to know how to articulate what your piece is and to live that out, be responsible for it. And in that responsibility, you'll discover a way to speak to others about their thread. And there's something about the specificity of knowing your piece, but being aware of the whole weave. And so it's just such a simple thing, but I guess that's what I would kind of want to close with and invite you all to as we're thinking about creativity, is to just think about for a moment, like for you, the, you know, affirmation and true discovery of yourself as writer, and now inviting people to the conversation and teaching about memoirs. Yes. And there are threads that also shift over time, because you had the thread before of journeying. And so for you all who have been journeying with us during this time, what is the thread that you feel like you're weaving?
Yes.
And some of us have many balls of yarn.
Right.
But they all start with the singularity of, if I only had this one to weave, what one would it be? And how would I give language to that?
And on that note, because we're coming to closure, that's a little message, but I think, I can't believe how fast the time's gone, but we love talking to each other. But with that, I was wondering if we could take some of this thread and thread it between us.
Absolutely.
And I'll have some. And it reminds me that last night I was in ritual with a Jewish group with a woman rabbi that I work with, Rabbi Daria, and it's earth-based Jewish spirituality.
Mm.
And she celebrates, she has new moon ceremonies for women, and she had a ball of yarn.
Oh, did she?
And we threaded, but we threw it across the room, you know, sort of
wove it.
We wove it. And so for you to bring the thread out reminded me, and that for millennia, I think, you know, we've been weaving the web.
We have.
We've been complete, and we continue to weave the web. And you're weaving the web with, you know, thousands of people around the planet. And so so I really hope that you will go to Shiloh's website if you haven't, if you're not familiar with her work, because people will know about you, but there's going to be a lot of other viewers from other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
you can go to shilohsophia.com is my personal site, and that has my blog, or cosmiccowgirls.com has all the classes, upcoming classes by my work and the work of my community.
Wonderful. And then there's the free gift.
The free gift is going to be called Tea with the Midnight Muse, or Tea with the Muse, actually. Midnight's the book part. And we'll be providing that here to you in a link form.
Excellent. And can you show the book again?
Absolutely.
Because it's such a gorgeous cover. And excellent.
There you go. Tea with the Midnight Muse. It's available on Amazon.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Well, and you're in Sonoma, and it's just beautiful. If people want to come out and do an actual physical class with you, if you don't live in Sonoma or California, put it on your bucket list, because it's a beautiful place. But doing a workshop with you will be an added bonus.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And we're recording live from Musea, our location here in Sonoma. But also just to say that if you go to thecosmiccowgirls.com and click on the Muse Days, it will take you to a page of over 50 Muse gatherings around the world that the women are leading in my community.
Oh.
Yeah. So you can actually do this with anyone.
Excellent.
I mean, not anyone, yeah. but I mean like lots of women around the world.
Yeah, because there will be people from around the world
yeah.
who are viewing this. So that's perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, grab the booth.
Sorry, you can grab my booth any day. Or did we just say that?
No, thank you.
Oh my gosh, it was so awesome to be with you again and reconnect around this, and just sending love to each of you. That it's hard to know where to look. So
yeah,
it's so weird sometimes.
Yeah, if we look weird.
If we look weird, we're meaning to look at you. Just that. We send you out love for you to write your story, heal your life, and those of you who feel called can also paint it.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Joanne.
And yeah.
Blessings.